Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices overlooking San Francisco's Market Street. We also welcome the listeners of KWGS-FM in Tulsa, Oklahoma, one of more than 225 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all of our listeners here in the audience and on radio to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's program, featuring Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld. Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld are nationally renowned attorneys specializing in civil rights and criminal cases. They are most known for their landmark litigation setting standards for forensic applications of DNA technology. Since 1988, their work has helped shape the course of case law across the country, as well as important state and federal legislation. They began their careers on the streets of New York, representing the very poor as public defenders at the Legal Aid Society. Barry and Peter first met on the job in 1977, subsequently forming a professional collaboration and lasting friendship based on a shared outrage over injustice. In 1978, Barry Scheck became a professor at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law, and Peter was in private practice. Both were collaborating on cases. In 1986, Barry and Peter took on a case that would change their lives and the life of an innocent man. Marion Coakley, considered mildly retarded, was suspected of rape and robbery. After leading an investigation and by developing a novel testing procedure of items stored in a prison freezer, Barry and Peter proved that the wrong man had indeed been imprisoned. The Coakley case compelled Barry and Peter to establish the Innocence Project. They established the Innocence Project in 1992, which seeks to free wrongly convicted people through DNA testing. Since 1992, they have helped free 38 wrongly convicted people and have 200 more cases pending. Barry serves on the National Institute of Justice's Commission on the Future of DNA Evidence. Both Barry and Peter are members of the New York State Commission on Forensic Science. Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, along with award-winning Pulitzer Prize columnist Jim Dwyer, are the co-authors of Actual Innocence. And in Actual Innocence, the authors combine their tremendous talent and years of experience to demonstrate the flaws and potential injustices of our criminal justice system and also underscore the positive and quite dramatic impact that advances of DNA identification methods are having on the wrongly accused and convicted. Please join me in welcoming the very esteemed Mr. Barry Scheck and Mr. Peter Neufeld.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction. And the way that we're going to do this is kind of like a tag team, sort of the way we approach most matters, and so we're going to go back and forth between topics. I'm just going to start by saying something about how we started with this book. We went in and we pitched these book publishers because with Jim Dwyer, this wonderful writer who had worked on a lot of the cases, we knew that we had to bear witness to what we were experiencing in these cases where DNA was exonerating innocent people. And one of the first things that the publisher said to us is, well, you know what? I'll tell you how you guys can really make it with this book. You write this book, and we go on this, you know, book tour, and the first thing that you guys have got to do, you got to guarantee me this. The day your book comes out, you got to get an innocent guy out of jail. Can you do that? And so, you know, we looked at him like he dropped from Mars, right? I mean, you know, well, it doesn't quite work that way. You can't work it out exactly that way. So sure enough, on Thursday, the book comes out, and we're on all these television shows and everything and going around, and all of a sudden the cell phone goes off. And it's this district attorney in Riverside, California, who says, you know, Herman Atkins, the FBI has confirmed the results of your laboratory. He did 12 years. He's an innocent man. We're going to let him go. So the day the book comes out, Herman Atkins walks out of a jail in Ironwood, California, a case that in many ways illustrates what we're going to talk about tonight, the difficulties of getting DNA tests, fraudulent and junk science, mistaken eyewitness identification, all the problems that we think we can do something about.
But let us assure you, this is not a book, nor is it a talk about DNA, about science. That's not why we wrote the book. That's not the main issues of the Innocence Project. Never before has there been a collection of cases like these 70, and right now we're up to 70 cases. Mr. Atkins is the 70th person in North America to be freed after he'd been convicted, after he'd exhausted his appeals through DNA evidence, 64 in the United States and 6 in Canada. But taking this group of cases, 70 cases, gave us a unique opportunity not to talk about DNA, because all we know about DNA is it got them out. It proved they were innocent. The much more compelling question for all of us is how'd they get in? What went wrong with the criminal justice system to permit innocent men 70 times to be convicted, to be sentenced to lengthy terms of imprisonment, and in 8 instances to be sentenced to death? And that's what this book is really about, because we've been able to cull through these cases and come up with certain trends and come up with the primary causes of unjust conviction in this country. And what are the kinds of things that we've discovered? Well, in about 84% of these cases, people were victimized by unreliable eyewitness identifications. Now, that's not a surprise for many people, but the extent of the problem, as manifested in these 70 cases, is extraordinary. Another cause, false confessions. And when I say false confessions, I mean either coerced confessions or the situation that you've all heard of where the police officer testifies in a court of law that Bobby made the following statement, and Bobby says, I never made any statement. Okay? Second problem is false confessions. 25% of these unjust convictions involve false confessions. What are the other problems? Sloppy science. A third of the cases involve sloppy or fraudulent forensic science utilized to convict an innocent man. Prosecutors who crossed the line, police officers who engaged in misconduct, defense attorneys who were asleep at the wheel or drunk or worse, completely indifferent, even in a sober state, to the injustices committed against their client. These are the kind of problems that we see in this case, and we describe all these problems through the very, very compelling stories of 10 different men.
And that's the way we organized it. It's issue by issue, but and we outline the issue. We give some simple remedies that we'll go into in a second to reform them. But most of all, this book is about some gut-wrenching, unbelievable stories of innocent people who were convicted, how it happened. And we are privileged to have worked with Jim Dwyer, who's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, is a wonderful guy and a great writer, who actually worked on a number of these cases with us. And what we think we've achieved here is to give you the feeling of what it's like. Imagine convicted for a crime you didn't commit. What is that experience? What kind of Kafkaesque, bizarre, unbelievable situation is it? How does it unfold? We try to take you and put you in the shoes of a high school teacher in Oklahoma, Dennis Fritz, a minor league ball player, Ron Williamson. Ron came within 5 days of execution. Dennis got life in jail. Or a fisherman in Maryland, Kirk Bloodsworth, who was convicted and sentenced to death for killing a little girl, a crime he didn't commit. Or a gravedigger in West Virginia, Glendale Woodall. These are the kinds of ordinary people that were swept up in these bizarre situations, and it's not just them. It's also their families, their parents, who are put into this situation.
Imagine, if you could, that you're the person standing in the dock, and you're the person who knows that you're innocent, but nevertheless, all these people are coming into court and testifying through either circumstantial evidence or scientific evidence that you're guilty. And 12 people are sitting there to decide your fate, and they walk out to deliberate, and then they march into that courtroom and announce a verdict of guilty. One of the people who we discuss in this book is a wonderful young man named Calvin Johnson. Calvin Johnson comes from a black middle-class family in Atlanta, Georgia. He had gone to college, and he was working in communications, and he was charged with raping a white woman in a suburb of Atlanta. And Calvin's alibi was that he was home with his mother and father. His father was a lawyer. His father had actually done some criminal cases when the family lived in Ohio and now was involved in business in the suburbs of Atlanta. And so the father knew he was innocent. And so Calvin Johnson sat there in a court of law with his father day after day after day, while these witnesses came in, women who were very, very sincere, they were victims of rape, who said that Calvin Johnson is the perpetrator. The father knew it wasn't true. Calvin knew it wasn't true, but they sat there. And finally, 12 white jurors retired to deliberate, came in with a verdict of guilty. And Calvin Johnson was sentenced to a life of imprisonment. He spent 16 years in prison before the DNA exonerated him. When I went up and asked Calvin's father, you know, what was it like for you? I mean, you knew that your son was with you. You knew he couldn't do this. You're a lawyer like we are. You believe in the system. You work in the system. How did that feel? How could you endure that? And he said, you know, Peter, you're very naive. You and Barry don't appreciate that, you know, we have all these niceties in the system, but you have to understand that race, at least my experience, race trumps truth. And I've grown to understand that my whole life, and I know it's, you know, not any different for my son. Now, those are the kind of stories that we talk about in this book, and those are the kind of stories which I know now that I'm a parent, I can't imagine being able to endure.
Now, take the case of Timothy Durham. You couldn't find two people more different than Calvin Johnson and Timothy Durham. Timothy Durham comes from a wealthy family in Tulsa, Oklahoma. His father owns a number of radio stations. The family owns a hardware business. Very prosperous, very successful. Tim Durham was in Dallas, Texas, with his father at a skeet shooting contest. I never knew what skeet shooting was, right? With 11 people. And Tim's father was kind of aged at this point, and they would shoot the skeets up in the air, and his father would shoot them, and there were these other people there, 11 people all together, deacons of churches, pillars of the community in Dallas and Tulsa were at the skeet shooting contest when Tim was accused of having sexually molested an 11-year-old girl in Tulsa, right? And he was a victim, it turns out, of junk DNA testing. And microscopic hair comparisons with that, frankly, DNA testing is proving is junk science that shouldn't be in the courts. Hair and bad DNA testing convicted him. A good DNA test exonerated him. But the point is, his parents, just like Calvin Johnson's, were driven crazy, were horrified that he could be put away for 6.5 years and sentenced to 3,200 years. And on appeal, they knocked it down to 3,100 years. For a crime he didn't commit, completely different than Calvin.
You know, and when we think about junk science, there's one case which we discuss in the book which sort of stands out as an example and a cautionary tale for the rest of the country. There's a guy named Glendale Woodall. Now, Glendale Woodall is neither the son of a middle-class black family, nor is he the son of a prosperous white family in Oklahoma. Glendale Woodall was a gravedigger. He was a gravedigger in West Virginia. And Glendale Woodall was accused of raping two women in a shopping mall in a suburb in West Virginia. And Glendale Woodall was convicted of those rapes. It was a wild kind of case, but one of the key pieces of evidence came from a gentleman named Fred Zane. And Fred Zane was the head of the West Virginia State Crime Laboratory. He was the chief serologist. And he had done the serology work in this case, which showed that the semen evidence recovered from the crime scene of both rapes was consistent with having come from Glendale Woodall. Very powerful evidence, and was used to convict him of both rapes. Well, later on, a lawyer took up the cause of Mr. Woodall and got DNA testing. And the DNA testing showed that he hadn't committed the crime, that he was completely excluded. But the DNA testing did more than that. People went back and looked at the underlying serology conducted by Fred Zane.
And a hair.
And they found out, okay, that Fred Zane's results didn't stand up under any scrutiny. They found out that Fred Zane did something that was called dry labbing. I don't know how many of you have a background in science, but dry labbing is when you don't ever do the experiment, okay? You're told that the police are looking for this guy, and they believe he's the perpetrator. And so the scientist simply writes a report concluding that based on his scientific test of the blood and the semen that you have a match, but he never does the experiments. And that's what they uncovered about Fred Zane. So what they decided to do was to go back, since Zane was the head of the laboratory, let's do an audit. The same way you would do an audit if a Ford Taurus blows up. You want to look at other Ford Tauruses? Well, here they wanted to look at other handiwork by Fred Zane. And when they looked at his work, they found out that he had committed scientific fraud in 133 cases. But that wasn't the end of it, because when he had to flee West Virginia, he moved on to San Antonio, Texas. It was like a disease spreading across the country.
And it's amazing. We ask ourselves, where were the lawyers? Why didn't they look at his underlying work? Where were the prosecutors? Where was the system? And it brings up the need to study these wrongful convictions. So first, before we go into some specific reforms, I'm going to give you an overview of the way we approached each of the problems in this book and one very big idea that we hope is taken up in the state of California and all across the country, and that's the idea of innocence commissions. When an airplane falls from the sky, or a car blows up, or there's an unexpected death at a hospital, when there's a total system failure, what happens? The National Transportation and Safety Board comes in. There's a huge postmortem. People conduct an investigation. Why was there a total system failure? What went wrong? Is anyone at fault? If anyone is at fault. And most important of all, if we find out some of the causes, how can we fix it to make sure it never happens again? The only system where this doesn't occur, the only institution where the life and liberty of citizens are at stake that doesn't conduct this kind of self-examination is the criminal justice system. When these 70 people walked out of jail with post-conviction DNA exonerations, judges just issue an order, just like they did in Riverside, California the other day for Herman Atkins. There's no opinion written. You can't find it in the law books. There's no analysis that goes on. What we're calling for is to look at these wrongful convictions, set up blue ribbon independent panels where people will examine these cases, write reports, find out and take seriously what are the causes of wrongful convictions and what we can do to stop it.
Tony Snyder, a young black man living with his mother and father in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. Tony worked as an oil burner repairman, and he had no criminal record. One day, a young white woman who lived across the street from the Snyders was raped, viciously raped, no question about it, and she described her assailant as a young black man. The police, trying to find the perpetrator, approached different young black men who lived in the community and asked permission to take their pictures with a Polaroid camera. These pictures were shown to the victim one day, and she said, "I couldn't make an identification." After looking at the photographs, she returned home, sat down in the living room, looked out the window, and there was Tony Snyder, whose picture she had just seen in the police department, washing his dad's car in the driveway. She scratched her head, thought about it for a minute, and said, "I know that face." Of course she knew that face. She had just seen the photograph at the police station. But she didn't think of it that way. She said, "My God, that's the guy who raped me." And so Tony Snyder is then picked up, brought to the precinct, where she has an opportunity to view him again, one-on-one, confirming that identification. And that's what led to his unjust conviction. 84% of these cases, as I mentioned earlier, involve mistaken eyewitness identification. We have a very simple reform here. In fact, most of the reforms that we're talking about are the kind of reforms that we believe will get bipartisan support. Democrats, Republicans, prosecutors, defense attorneys. They're very straightforward, they're very simple, and everybody benefits from them. With respect to eyewitness identification, what we're talking about is instead of having the investigator who's biased, who's involved with the case, have the photo identification procedures run by an objective, neutral police officer who's trained in this, so there'll be no subtle verbal or gesture cues to the victim who's looking at the photographs. Show them one photograph at a time so they're not comparing one to another. They're making objective determinations. That's a very simple remedy, and it would get rid of a lot of mistaken eyewitness identifications. The second one, equally simple.
And a lot of, just to, before he goes on, and there are many others like that in the eyewitness area, but interestingly, they're all contained in a recent publication by the National Institute of Justice, Eyewitness Identification, A Guide for Law Enforcement, a consensus view of professors, law enforcement officials, yet these guidelines really are not followed in most jurisdictions in this country, if any.
The second simple one, false confessions. What's the remedy? Simply videotape all interrogations. That's all. It's used in England right now. It's used in Alaska. It's used in Minnesota. There's no reason why it can't be used everywhere in the country. And is it going to just help defendants? No, it's going to help everybody. Why is it going to help everybody? Because obviously, if someone's alleging that they never made the statement, And if there's no record of that statement, that helps a defendant who's being falsely accused. On the other hand, if a defendant makes...
Or rightly accused.
Right. If a defendant makes the specious allegation that he's been coerced, it's been beaten out of him, he's been tricked, and the police officer has a tape which proves that nothing untoward occurred, that only supports the prosecutor's version of what happened. In those jurisdictions where they're using tape recordings routinely, everybody benefits.
In New York State, Peter and I helped draft legislation about 5 or 6 years ago setting up something called the Forensic Science Commission, which is actually a group of people, prosecutors, defense lawyers, crime lab directors. We regulate the crime labs. We make sure they're all accredited. We regulate our DNA data banks. We try to train the police officers on how to collect the evidence, use DNA testing appropriately. That's the kind of reform that you should have here in the state of California and all across the country. Make sure all the labs at the very least are accredited and operating in a professional way. That's a reform to help with junk science and even fraudulent science. I mean, if they'd done an audit of Fred Zane, how long could he go on? Another very important reform, and it is illustrated again by the Herman Atkins case. I mean, there was some fraudulent serological testimony offered at the time of Herman's trial that maybe if you had a regulatory body would have been protected against. But what about those people that are in jail right now, and there are thousands of them, who could prove their innocence with a post-conviction DNA test? It's quite remarkable. There are only two states in this country, Illinois and New York, that have a statute that says something very simple. If you could prove your innocence with a DNA test, you were arrested a long time ago before DNA tests were invented or sophisticated ones existed, and there's some biological evidence that you could test that would be determinative, if the tests were in your favor, would raise a reasonable probability that you were wrongly convicted or sentenced, shouldn't you be able to get that test? Illinois and New York say yes. And if you, no statute of limitations should prevent you from making this motion, no time limits, no procedural bars, and number two, if you can't afford it, the state will provide it for you. It's not that expensive, $3,000 to $5,000 in most instances. Interestingly, in Illinois, there have been 14 exonerations. In New York, 7 exonerations. It's not a coincidence. Those are the two highest totals in the United States. Senator Leahy has recently introduced legislation in Congress, the Innocence Protection Act, that would require this in every state. State Senator Burton has introduced a bill here in California that would provide the same thing in this state. All of you should get behind it and make sure it happens now, because in 75% of these cases that come in for requests to the Innocence Project, where a DNA could prove innocence, we can't find the evidence. It's been lost or destroyed. So we're really in a race to get people out of jail who didn't commit crimes before the evidence is lost or destroyed.
And it will save money. Take Herman Atkins, for instance, down in Riverside, California. Herman Atkins fought for more than 3 years to get DNA testing. The prosecutor resisted during those 3 years, said Herman's guilty. He had no right to this. Procedurally, he was barred. No one should give it to him. You know, the way he got DNA testing was completely serendipitous. We filed a motion, and the district attorney who had been opposed to granting testing all along one day failed to come to court. Someone else in the office stood in who said, oh, this sounds like a good idea. And a judge simply signed the papers, and we were off and running, and we got the DNA test, and he was cleared. 3 years. It cost $3,000 to do this DNA test, maybe $5,000 in a tough case. It cost $25,000 for the state of California to keep this man in that prison cell. This man spent 12 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. That's $300,000. For the $300,000 saved, 100 different people in the state of California could have had post-conviction DNA testing. Everybody wins financially.
Now let's take the state of Illinois and look at the remarkable events there. The fact of the matter is that a pro-death penalty governor, Governor Ryan, called for a moratorium on executions because 13 people had been proven innocent who had been sentenced to death compared to 12 who had been executed in his state. And he said, wow, something is wrong. Interestingly, he also then went on to do one of the first suggestions we made, set up, in a sense, an innocence commission, asking the question, let's get a blue ribbon panel together. Why were these 13 innocent people convicted? But it's important to note that only 4 of those death row cases in Illinois were cleared by DNA. The rest were from other evidence. And that's really why we wrote this book, because of all these other problems in the criminal justice system. We think that something And DNA is, of course, part of the engine. But we want to look at other cases where innocent people have been convicted, because when you reexamine them, something happens. So many of the exonerations in Illinois came about because some journalism students working with David Protes at Northwestern University, 18-year-olds, went out, reinvestigated cases of people on death row who claimed they were innocent, and within a matter of months found witnesses that exonerated them. Something is really wrong when that can happen. But on the other hand, why not do it here in the Bay Area, as we'll discuss in a second?
You know, people think generally that, well, now we're going to have DNA testing routinely in all these cases, so it's going to be much less likely that we'll have a wrongful conviction in the future. Wrong. And wrong because the overwhelming majority of cases involving violent crime don't involve biological evidence. There's no DNA testing. If I take a baseball bat and bang him over the head and kill him and flee, I haven't left semen behind. I haven't left my blood behind. His blood may not be on me. This gentleman could be falsely accused for something I did because he was seen in the vicinity of Mr. Sheck. The point is this. All the kinds of problems that we're pointing out here are going to continue to be a problem unless we address them right now. There will be thousands of wrongful convictions in the future. One of the key causes of unjust convictions that we point out in the book is police misconduct. In fact, in 50% of the 70 cases documented, there was significant police misconduct. All of you have been looking at the pages the last few days, and you've seen the scandal unraveling in Los Angeles involving the Rampart Police Station. Now, there you have a situation where DNA evidence is not going to free those people. They're simply framed, okay? But one of the things that's also equally disturbing to us about the Rampart situation, which I don't think has been discussed very much, is that so far there have been 40 convictions vacated. And the popular wisdom is that in the next couple of weeks, that number is going to skyrocket to 100.
The police chief
But you know
that.
What's extraordinary about those 100 people? What's really extraordinary to us, as having been public defenders, 99 out of 100 of those guys who were framed pled guilty. So not only do you have misconduct by police, you have public defenders who are coercing their clients into taking pleas when they are stone-cold innocent. So these are systemic problems which need to be addressed.
And it should be said that in our cases, only one instance of these murders and sexual assaults did somebody who was innocent plead guilty. All right, and that was somebody who was actually had mental problems in the state of Virginia. The fact is that in these other cases, besides the public defenders or the court-appointed lawyers or whomever was representing those 99 people that pled guilty, there are also things we have to look at in terms of the bail system, in terms of mandatory minimums and three strikes that basically put people in a position where they felt they had no choice. So what are we going to do about all of this? We have come to the Bay Area, where I went to law school at Bolthole School of Law and the University of California at Berkeley.
And something I sometimes hold against him.
Right, because it was a good place to go to school. And we went up there. We were just with the students there this afternoon. We're going to be reaching out to people in the journalism school there. And there were literally hundreds of students that were coming forward and saying, we want to work on some of these kinds of cases. We want to reexamine the system here. And when an article appeared in the Chronicle just the other day that we were going to Bolt, we got a call from Professor Robert Weisberg at Stanford Law School. So yesterday we met with the students at Stanford, and we've had requests from professors at UC Davis and Hastings and USF Law School. Some students from USF are here tonight. I think that there is a feeling now that we have to look at this system. And it's not just lawyers and law students, but it's also got to be journalists. It's got to be citizens, journalists in particular, because it was really journalists and journalism students that reexamined that system in Illinois. It was these journalists, Ken Armstrong and Steve Mills and Maurice Posley, who did these amazing exposés of the death row inmates in Illinois, looking at the hundreds on death row and finding things, for example, that 20% of these inmates were represented by lawyers who had been subsequently disbarred or suspended. Right? Now, why aren't some journalists taking a look? We don't believe that the criminal justice system in Illinois is appreciably worse than Texas. Come on, Governor Bush, you don't think that anybody innocent has been convicted and put on death row in Texas. How can you have that kind of confidence? You don't even have a post-conviction DNA statute in your state. It's not worse than Texas, Virginia, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and dare I say it, as a California lawyer, the state of California. I don't believe Illinois is appreciably worse. I just think that people are looking at the cases more carefully there, that there's this innocence network forming of lawyers and journalists and concerned citizens, and that's what we are trying to bring as we go across the country with this book, and we hope it happens here in the state of California.
You know, and people have to appreciate that when you do this kind of post-conviction DNA testing that we're talking about, we're not simply interested in freeing people who have been wrongly convicted. Of these 70 people who have now been freed through post-conviction DNA typing, in 15 instances, we've been able to take the crime scene evidence after a person's been exonerated, go into a data bank in a state or a locality, and identify the true perpetrator. So this kind of post-conviction testing not only helps us to free the wrongfully convicted, but also helps us to identify the real perpetrators. And let's bear in mind that every time we falsely convict somebody who's innocent, we are allowing the true perpetrator to remain on the street. So if you're seeking truth, all the kinds of reforms that we're talking about will help the criminal justice system and will help everybody in this country. Sometimes folks say to us, you know, why do you do this? We understand why you do it. I mean, systemically, we understand the political motivations, but are there other concerns? For me, at least, I like to think of an occasion, gosh, it's almost 8 years ago now, when we worked on the Tony Snyder case, which was one of our first cases. And Tony has one of those mothers who we all wish we had, who stood by her son the whole time he was in prison. She, on her own, when she first heard about DNA, started calling up the scientists who invented the technology in England and France to get their help. She was working as a postal worker. She put a second mortgage on her house to get appellate counsel. She wrote letters to the president, the governor, the senators, all to no avail. Finally, she got in touch with us. You know, there was DNA testing done, and Tony Snyder one day went to the governor seeking a pardon for Tony. And the reason we had to get a pardon for Tony is that under Virginia's statute, you only have 21 days after a conviction to move to set aside a conviction based on newly discovered evidence. 21 days, that's it. I mean, and you're in a catch-22, because obviously you also have to be able to prove that it's something that you couldn't have found out before the trial was over. And obviously, if there's something you could learn within 21 days after the conviction, you should have known about it before. So it's a statute which no one can ever avail themselves of, and he couldn't avail himself of it. But we moved for a pardon from the governor. The district attorney joined us in seeking a pardon. The governor was shaking because he was so scared that if he signed this pardon, even though the guy was innocent, it would be another Willie Horton fiasco for him, and he would never get reelected next November. But fortunately, there were some courageous journalists in Richmond, Virginia, who took him to task and put pressure on him, and he did the right thing, and he granted the pardon. I got a call from the governor's office that they were going to pardon him and release him, so I hopped on a plane and went down to Richmond, Virginia. I had spoken to this man's mother on the phone 30 or 40 times, but I'd never met her. And I get off this small plane, and it's, you know, you don't enter right into the terminal. You walk down the stairs, and you're on the tarmac. And all of a sudden, this woman, who was a middle-aged woman, I guess in those days I thought that was much older. Now I have new appreciation for middle age. Literally, she comes bounding down the tarmac, and she gets to me, and she gets me in this bear hug and just lifts me off the ground. And, you know, the truth be told, I weigh about 220 pounds. It's not an easy guy to lift off the ground. She had no trouble. And she gave me the kind of hug that, you know, if you get it once in your life, you're way ahead of the curve. And it was a great moment, and it's a moment that I'll never forget. And it's a moment that will influence my decisions in criminal justice and everything else I do for the rest of my life.
So, Skip, I think we're ready for questions.
Okay.
Barry Sevenoff. Thank you, Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, co-founders of the Innocent Project and co-authors, along with Jim Dwyer, of Actual Innocence. At this time, Skip Rhodes, president of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct our question and answer session.
Thank you, Darian Weltman Swig, our quarterly chair. And gentlemen, we have a large number of questions, so let's get at it right away. First question, is our adversarial judicial system the best way to find the truth, and are juries the best judges of what is true?
Boy, that's a tough question and a long answer, but I'll try to make it short. I think that
We're believers in the adversary system, but I think the primary problem in the United States is that class, money, and race seems to affect the adversary system to the point that I wonder if we really have one. It's not a very enviable position to be innocent and poor or even middle class in terms of being able to find a good lawyer or experts or to rely upon a system where forensic scientists are supposed to be independent professionals, but unfortunately in too many instances don't have the funds to be anything more than police officers in lab coats and not adhere to the kind of professional standards that they would want if they were in a better position. So when you have a system where so much is wrong and so much seems to depend on how much money you have and even the color of your skin, to get a fair adversarial trial, I would wonder really whether the adversary system is working as intended. Of course, it's not a perfect system. I happen to believe that in theory, it's about the best you can come up with. I spent a lot of time, for example, with judges and professors from China. Okay, recently at the Yale Law School, and listening to those stories, I realized the genius of the Fifth Amendment and the adversary system. But believe me, you don't want to be in a country where the main way that evidence is gathered in a criminal investigation is they first start off by interrogating the suspect, right? The quality of cases is not very good. But on the other hand, if you don't have good lawyers and you don't have a vigorous system, a vigorous adversary system, and where you're putting the prosecution to the test so that it gets good proof, so people like Fred Zane can't be dry labbing because nobody discovers them, then the system breaks down. And that's unfortunately the situation we're in this country.
Barry, where did you learn and pick up your sense of social justice? And then a second part of the question, which may have been prompted by Peter's earlier comment, how important was your Bolt Law School education?
Oh, boy. I guess I got it, of course, from my parents, my father actually was born on the Lower East Side of New York. He never got out of high school. He came from one of those large, poor families in the Depression era, and he was a tap dancer. He learned how to tap dance from a black janitor in a bank. And believe it or not, he played the Apollo Theater. And I think that those origins made him, you know, really involved, even though he was in show business, with the civil rights movement. And I think that that perspective really is, what was passed on to me, and I hope on to my children. And as for Bolt Hall School of Law, how do I be diplomatic about this? I went to school with a lot of great people who are doing some wonderful things today. And some good professors, too.
Moving swiftly on, how commonly available is DNA evidence? Is it likely to revolutionize criminal law?
Well, I mean, there's no question that the development of DNA testing does revolutionize the criminal justice system. There's no question it's the most significant advance in criminal justice and investigation since fingerprinting. And in a large number of cases, it will streamline criminal justice because clearly in cases where the biological evidence is critical to the identity of the perpetrator as opposed to a self-defense or a consent issue, in those cases, if the DNA test includes somebody, it's more likely to end in a plea. If the DNA test excludes someone, it's much more likely that the prosecutors will dismiss the charges. So things will happen faster, things will happen more cheaply. On the other hand, as we said before, in the overwhelming majority of violent crimes, there is no biological evidence. And so no matter how much they perfect DNA testing, it's not going to answer the question of identity. And unless we embark on the kind of meaningful reforms that we outline in Actual Innocence, we are doomed to repeat the same errors for 100 years to come.
Why did you decide to defend O.J. Simpson? Do you feel that your participation has had a negative impact on DNA credibility and your own credibility?
Oh, boy. That was an interesting thing. We wound up being hired to consult with the lawyers in the O.J. Simpson case really at the time that the Bronco was heading around the freeway before any kind of forensic testing had been done. And, never anticipated that we would have any kind of a large role in that case or anything that followed. In terms of the outcome, the aftermath of the O.J. Simpson case, I've always found it extremely disturbing. I don't think that there's very much good that's come out of the O.J. Simpson case for the criminal justice system, except for perhaps one thing. And that is the only silver lining is the reaction of the forensic community, because it's misunderstood, I think, to a large degree. We never contested. Just ask the prosecutors who opposed us, Rock Harmon and Woody Clark. We never contested the reliability of the DNA testing. What we were pointing out is that the way that the evidence was collected and handled, both at the crime scene and in the laboratory itself initially, was a disaster. And nobody really disputes that. What's really fascinating now is that, as was indicated, I sit on this federal commission where we train law enforcement officers and hand out things to them on how to deal with DNA evidence. So there's a little pamphlet that says what every law enforcement officer ought to know about DNA evidence. And you read it, and it says, never put anything into plastic bags when wet. Always change your gloves when you handle the sample. Don't take the reference sample at the same time that you handle everything else. On and on and on it goes. And basically what it is the cross-examination of the evidence handlers in the Simpson case. And I think that the people in the forensic community recognize that that uncrowded laboratory did nobody any favors and have tried to respond and deal with the issue in a positive way, and certainly Peter and I have.
You know, one of the great gaps in America right now is the disparity in treatment between clinical medicine and clinical tests and crime laboratories and forensic tests. If you have a growth on your hand and they're going to remove that growth and they're going to do a biopsy on it, you want to be sure, you want to be confident that the people in that laboratory who are doing the testing know the difference between a malignancy and something that's not malignant, because there's going to be a lot of consequences for you. And to a certain extent, we have that confidence. Well, and one of the reasons we have that confidence is that clinical laboratories and their tests are regulated. And the individuals who participate are proficiency tested. And the individuals are certified to do the right thing. Well, nothing like that prior to the Simpson case existed nationwide for crime laboratories. They were using similar technologies as clinical laboratories. They were making very, very heady decisions about whether or not someone could fry an electric chair, but there was no quality control, there was no accreditation, there was no certification. None of those things existed. As a result of what happened in the Simpson case, laboratories for the first time all over the country were going out and trying to get accredited because they didn't want to find themselves in the same vulnerable position as the Los Angeles Police Department laboratory was in the Simpson case.
Yeah, one brief point. In New York City, as a result of our requirements, our commission, that every lab be accredited, the New York City Police Department had to spend an extra $33 million to make sure that their new facility would be accredited. And a man whom Peter and I sue very often, Howard Safer, the police commissioner in New York City, will tell you that every penny was worth spending.
Following up on your just concluded remarks, would you please discuss accountability? Where are the investigations of crooked police and prosecutors and subsequent indictments or at least firings? How can our faith in the system be restored without accountability?
Well, first let me just talk about one kind of accountability. I want to talk briefly about accountability in the crime laboratory, and then maybe Barry can address the broader question of prosecutors. In the Atkins case, the case where the fellow in Riverside County was released a couple of days ago, in that case, a serologist had committed scientific fraud 12 years ago when he testified about the significance of certain serological evidence. Now, in the past, if something like that was uncovered, they would go, oops, we made a mistake, and that's it. It would be nothing more than a blip, nothing more than an anecdote. But what we've done is we've called upon the Attorney General here in the state of California to go back now and do an audit, not just of this one serologist's work. He'd been there 10 years when he did this case, and he is still there today serving in a supervisory capacity in that crime laboratory. Listen, there's nothing special about Herman Atkins. If he could commit scientific fraud in the Atkins case, it's very likely that he did it in other cases. It's just like the biopsy on a growth. If you found out that the laboratory screwed up on one case, you would want to do an audit to see whether or not the laboratory screwed up in other cases within the same time frame. So we're now asking the Attorney General to conduct that kind of audit just for that purpose, so there will be accountability. Otherwise, you people in California can't be assured that the people in that laboratory, when they say it's a match, know what they're talking about, or when they say it's an exclusion, and perhaps some guilty person is getting off, know what they're talking about.
In terms of building up overall confidence, again, in this system, in light of so many of these problems that are emerging, I think we can do it in a bipartisan way. We tried very, very hard. When you read our book, you'll see this. In spotting each of these issues that arose from the wrongful convictions, we also felt it was incumbent upon us to come up with mainstream reforms, simple solutions but effective ones, mainstream kinds of proposals that would be endorsed, we feel, by prosecutors, defense lawyers, Republicans, and Democrats, things, frankly, that have been out there for quite some period of time, but nobody seemed to have the political will to go through with. I mean, take even this post-conviction DNA testing statute. I mean, look, who can seriously oppose a test that would prove somebody innocent who was wrongfully convicted? It makes no sense. And many of the other suggestions are really the ID stuff. It's been out there for some time. But now maybe we can get fair-minded people on both sides of this system, the prosecutorial defense side, the judges, and others, journalists, into looking at this in a serious and fair-minded way, and we can make some real progress.
Have you taken on cases that you initially thought were wrongful convictions only to conclude that the person was in fact guilty?
Yes. In fact, at the Innocence Project, let's see, we've probably brought to laboratory to date approximately 5 dozen cases at the Innocence Project. That's 5 dozen cases where the people raised identity as an issue at trial, where biological evidence was collected in a relevant fashion, and where that evidence exists today. Of the 5 dozen cases where we went to lab, in 3 dozen of those cases, or 38 cases now, we got DNA exclusions. In the other 2 dozen cases, the DNA confirmed the guilt of the perpetrator. And in each case, those results were communicated to all the parties who participated in the trial.
And we make sure that the clients know that going in, because in this situation, we feel that, you know, you can take the DNA profile, you can put it in the data bank when our data banks get up to speed, and you can clear other cases. So, you know, we're in this to get to the truth in these cases.
The next question. Politicians are always competing with each other to be the toughest on crime. How are they responding to your work at the Innocence Project?
Well, that's a great question. Because there has been, unfortunately, an enormous amount of demagoguery on the issue of crime. One of the interesting things is that if you go to bar association meetings and you talk with prosecutors and judges, you know, people within the system fear the next big draconian mandatory minimum, throw away the key, let's get tough proposal that are run in the political campaigns, which make life impossible for people within the system. They're not necessarily deterring. They're not even incapacitating in an appropriate way. They're not doing much to solve crime, much less make the system work effectively. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of demagoguery. And what we're hoping by writing a book of this kind that offers mainstream solutions and points out things that are, you know, really indisputable in terms of the results of these DNA tests, and really calling to the attention of the public and decision makers, hey, wake up, right? When nothing like this has ever happened before, 70 people exonerated in such a short period of time and many more to come, shouldn't we take a look for everybody's sake?
You know, but I think the first breach in that wall of demagoguery occurred quite recently with a courageous Governor Ryan in Illinois. Here's a man who was certainly in favor of capital punishment, a moderate or Republican conservative, depending upon who you talk to, who nevertheless realized that the machinery of death in his state was not functioning properly. And he wanted to know, why is it that 13 men had been sentenced to death, had those death sentences affirmed on appeal, only to be exonerated, only to be proven to be innocent. That was unacceptable to him, and so he called for a moratorium. We are hopeful that other governors in other states, and perhaps even the president, will change his mind and think that a moratorium is the appropriate remedy at this point in time while we all study the problem of why it is that innocent people are being convicted and pose the potential of being executed.
And right, keep this in mind. It's not some, you know, crazy, left-wing defense lawyer saying this. For the last, I think it's 4 years now, the American Bar Association, which is the mainstream legal organization in this country, has called for a moratorium on the death penalty on the grounds that the representation of people in capital cases is a shambles in terms of the money provided for the lawyers. The problems of race and the fair administration of it are just terrible. And so the ABA has been calling upon people to do what Governor Ryan did. And, I don't really think it's an answer. When I was watching the debates the other day and Governor Bush said, oh, well, that's an Illinois problem. Can't possibly be true in Texas. When we see the courts there affirming convictions in cases where lawyers slept through the trial. Lawyers slept through the trial and the court affirms a conviction saying, no problem here.
You know, Barry brings up the question of race. And We didn't really mention it before, but for every single cause of unjust convictions, the one theme that sort of overlays all of them is the question of race. In this country, according to the data reported by the United States Department of Justice, most sexual assaults are committed by people within the same race. In other words, black men are reported to be the primary rapists of black women. White men rape white women. In fact, very few, only about 10% of the rapes are cross-racial, black men raping white women. Yet, very disturbingly, in almost half of our unjust conviction cases, they were black men who had been convicted of raping white women. You know, in the old days, it would be called the usual offense. In Georgia, where Calvin Johnson was convicted of raping a white woman by an all-white jury, only to be cleared by DNA testing, in the first half of this century, 62 men were executed for the crime of rape. Of the 62 men who were executed for the crime of rape, 58 of them were black men. And of those 58 men who were executed for the crime of rape, 90% of them were convicted of raping white women. So that problem, which existed in the first half of the century, plagues us to this day.
And one thing that's interesting, we haven't mentioned the question of compensation. In most of these cases, when these poor men walk out of jail with their lives ruined after being wrongfully convicted or sometimes sentenced to death, there really is no remedy for them. There really isn't a civil rights suit that they can bring because of various kinds of immunities. And so what they really need is compensation by a state statute. There are very few states that have that. Very frequently what has to happen is that the legislature has to pass a private bill to compensate them, although we would like to see compensation statutes in various states. But there's one thing that we're really interested in for our client Herman Atkins, who walked out the door last week from Riverside, California. In Santa Ana, California, in Orange County, a Marine, a good friend of ours, Kevin Green, was exonerated for a crime he didn't commit. He got 17 years in jail, and recently the legislature in California gave him upwards of $760,000 to compensate him in a private bill. Now, we should have a bill in California. Currently, the bill in California gives an inmate who was wrongfully convicted $10,000 for the entire term, which is kind of ridiculous when you think about it. But we would very much like to see people do the right thing for Herman Atkins, a black man from Riverside, California, that they did for Kevin Green, the white Marine from Orange County.
DNA evidence aside, how do you believe most Americans feel about the ethics of criminal defense attorneys?
You got to be here. Well, you know, that's a tough question. Obviously, there are problems there because the nature of the criminal defense lawyer, I think, is not quite understood. Obviously, you have to defend people sometimes that you know are guilty to force the state to its proof beyond a reasonable doubt in order to make the system work. I mean, the criminal defense lawyers
Most of them, court-appointed public defenders, laboring in the vineyards every day, are liberty's last champions. They're the people that are really protecting our freedoms, because that's a real tough job. And if they don't do the job, then you get the Fred Zanes, you get the Ramparts cases, you get all these problems. We really depend. It goes back to that question asked before about the adversary system. In order for our liberties to be protected, you need people to do that tough job. But I will say this. The television show The Practice, I think, is very helpful. I remember when I was growing up, there was a television show called The Defenders, right, that I think was terrific, really influenced me, that asked the question, in a way, can you be a good person and a good lawyer? And I think in an interesting way, very frequently on that show, The Practice, and, you know, similar kinds of things, they struggle with those issues. In many ways, it's a very interesting and difficult job, but in the end, I think it's the criminal defense lawyer that's really protecting everybody's freedom.
One question that I think we want to get in here before we have to draw to a close is, the writer says, don't keep us in suspense. Was Fred Zane charged with a crime? And if so, what was the charge and or result?
Well, Fred Zane, there was a great public defender who fought very, very hard, George Castell in West Virginia, to see Fred Zane brought to justice. Fred Zane was indicted. He was indicted in West Virginia. And Fred Zane has fought to maintain his freedom, both in West Virginia and in Texas. There's an investigation also in Texas. And I guess Barry will finish this answer, but at this point, Fred Zane still walks the streets a free man. Although recently, an appellate court in West Virginia reversed the decision that Fred Zane could not be tried, and he will be tried again in West Virginia.
Yeah, the problem was is that initially they took the position that the statute of limitations had run on the substantive misstatements that he had made in West Virginia and in Texas. The Texas prosecutors have never proceeded against him, but in West Virginia, the first time he was indicted was for something trivial when you think of it, which was misrepresenting whether or not on his resume as to whether or not he had failed or taken an organic chemistry course or something to that effect. And that's what he was charged with initially, because they didn't charge him with giving false evidence about or not performing the test that he purported to perform. And so he was, I think, acquitted in that case. But then he was recharged. A judge initially threw it on substantive offenses. The judge threw it out on the statute of limitations ground, I believe, or something similar to that. And the West Virginia Supreme Court has recently reinstated that, so he will finally be brought to trial on some of the substantive offenses.
Unfortunately, we've come to that time in our program where we have time for just one final question, and it is, can DNA be used to establish who was really guilty in the O.J. Simpson case?
Well, no. The problem, as we said earlier, in the Simpson case, is not with the DNA testing at all. It's the way the police department initially mishandled the collection, processing, and preservation of the evidence. Once you engage in that kind of hopeless contamination of the evidence, you can't unravel it. It's the old adage, you know, garbage in, garbage out. The good news is that the Los Angeles Police Department, at least they take the position that through new training and new standards and accreditation, will never commit those blunders again. We'll see.
Our thanks to Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, co-founders. Again, our thanks to Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, co-founders of the Innocence Project and co-authors of Actual Innocence. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening on radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest continuous public affairs forum, is adjourned.